I haven't seen Space Jam since it first came out.
But didn't you have the CD?
No, I never had the number.
Yeah.
Welcome to the Jam.
You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are all rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a baller. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bone. He shattered the mold and all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538. With me in the studio today on this beautiful Tuesday afternoon in New York City, it's Neil Statman Payne. Hello, Neil.
Hello, Chadwick.
Neil, our Mets suck.
They do.
Good to know. And with us also is Kate Fagan, ESPN W columnist and 538's fidget spinner correspondent. Kate, what are your thoughts on the new toy craze sweeping the country?
I think it's just another form of distraction, Chad.
Okay, so here's my thought. What if you take as a given that you're going to be distracted?
Why? Why do we have to accept that?
Impose your own cognitive...
What if I take it as a given that I will be distracted? That I will need some secondary thing going on in my life beyond the immediate task at hand. And therefore, I should choose the most...
The lesser of two evils?
Yes, the least distracting thing.
Have there been studies on, like, does the fidget
I don't want to accept the premise that you're going to be distracted no matter what. I'd rather just attempt to sit in silence and see where my mind goes.
So I'm not talking about the science. I'm saying I'm on the phone with somebody.
Right.
And I don't want to be checking Twitter in the background because it's rude. So instead, I twirl a little spinny thing.
And do you think that that's the majority of usage of the twirly spinny thing?
Yeah, well, journalists on the phone, I think, are the key demographic.
Like, when are people doing this?
Well, kids
just
are doing
on the
it in
subway
class.
And yeah. Just like
I'm not saying it, I don't on balance I don't think fidget spinners are a force for good in the world.
Honestly, they're probably pretty neutral.
Yeah. Exactly. So, no need for hate.
There's way bigger forces of evil in the world.
All right, on today's show we will not be talking about fidget spinners any longer. We will, however, talk about Derek Jeter, the captain. And what his legacy is now that he is enshrined in the Yankees' retired number. What do they call that? Monument Park?
Yeah.
Now that he is immortal in the eyes of the immortal franchise.
It's too bad that area is not in play anymore. It used to be actually like possible for balls to hit it because
and dent Derek Jeter's
it would
head.
Like dent the very kind of like poor likeness of Jeter on the
field. It's not that like him, actually, that likeness.
Yeah. No, it does not look like maybe like burn victim Derek Jeter or something like that. Like, I don't know what they were going for there.
We will also on today's show talk about home court advantage, home ice advantage, home field advantage.
All the home advantages,
whether it means anything in today's sports scene, why it might mean something in some leagues more than others. But first, we're going to talk about the NBA because the playoffs are still happening. They've gotten pretty interesting.
For like half the teams, they're happening. The other half just sit around.
The conference finals are set, and here to discuss it with us is Kyle Wagner.
Hey.
So, Kyle, welcome back. We are here to talk about, I think, the Spurs. Let's do the Spurs and Warriors first, and we'll get to the preview of the Eastern Conference Finals. The news coming out of the first game is Kawhi Leonard's injury, sort of ignoring this incredible comeback that the Warriors went on. Or perhaps Kawhi Leonard's injury is because
yes,
the Warriors then went on the comeback. Leonard was first landed on David Lee's foot awkwardly, out of bounds, and then Zaza Pachulia landed on Leonard's foot. And Leonard has an ankle injury as a result, is going to miss game two. It's unclear what happens after that. And all to say, while that happened, is that the Warriors overcame a huge deficit. I think they were down, 25 it was mm-hmm. the biggest. And so the Warriors won game one in a tight game. Kyle, is it too facile to say that because Leonard went down, the Warriors were able to do their run?
Of course not. He's one of the best players in the league, and he's also really, besides Patty Mills, the only one who can initiate that offense. Like, they have to bring in Kyle Anderson to try to fill the Boris Diaw role. when he's not in there. Deontay Murray has done a pretty good job in the playoffs, but the offense just stopped working, and they just threw the ball to LaMarcus all fourth quarter, and LaMarcus has kind of shown us that he's not really built for that.
So what does this mean for the Spurs going forward? Is this a matter of let's do the full scenario of him being out for the rest of the series, and then maybe, you know, he comes back later in the series. We're recording this on Tuesday afternoon. There may be more results by the time you hear this. So is this, you know, who takes Leonard's possessions once he's out, and then have the Spurs figured out a way to adapt to this in the past?
All right. So the good news is that they've been okay without Kawhi and Tony Parker throughout the season. They had, I think, a 106 offensive rating, a 98 defensive rating. That's really, really good.
That's without those two players.
Without those two players on the floor. And when they're not on the floor, who picks up the slack generally are LaMarcus Aldridge and Pau Gasol. Pau Gasol is at 30. They're both over 30 usage percent, which is a lot. They're just throwing it into the post, letting them work.
And it's kind of interesting that one of the arguments against Kawhi as MVP was that there wasn't that much of a difference for the Spurs when he was in the game versus when he wasn't in the game, which makes it all the more kind of ironic that when he got injured in game one, they just got smoked from that point out.
But when you talk about the 106 and 98 ratings, is there any way to break out within that, like what they did against actual top tier teams? Because we always talk about like maintaining even points per game from the regular season to the postseason is almost impossible for, you know, great players even like LeBron. Well, I'm just wondering, like, how much of that within that regular season was like really good teams versus just mediocre?
I mean, a lot of those minutes are just by definition going to be against bench units when you don't have Kawhi and you don't have Parker, and they rested a lot of games. But yeah, of course, that's you know, muted in the playoffs. So like another stat to look at, which is, you know, Kawhi's importance is really, really high, is in the playoffs in the fourth quarter, Kawhi has a 34% usage rate in the playoffs in fourth quarter and a 77.5 true shooting percentage, which is preposterous. Like, he's just getting points basically every time he uses the ball. So he's carrying them through these fourth quarters. And so, like, yeah, like, those have been bench units, like, when they haven't had Kawhi and Parker. So, obviously, you're right.
What have we seen from LaMarcus Aldridge back when he was with the Blazers that would lead us to believe that he, in any way, would be capable of stepping up and being the number one? Because, I mean, he had Dame Lillard for most of his time in Portland. Like, is there anything historically with LaMarcus Aldridge where we're like, hey, for this year or that year, his usage rate, even though I know he's a big guy, so it's not going to be as high, like, it's possible that he is up to this challenge?
I mean, I feel like that's a question for you. Like, is there anything that, like, you've seen from LaMarcus that, like, leads you to believe that?
No, but that's a total eye test or gaze, as we like to call it here, at least as I like to call it here. Like, no, there's nothing that I've seen, but I didn't know if there's something in the numbers, like a stretch or a certain part or something I'm missing where it's like, no, this is LaMarcus Aldridge. I mean, you're paying him so much free agent money in the offseason.
Well,
like, maybe
it's
possible.
Isn't there a universe that where Aldridge gets hot from mid-range and inside and just needs an adequate facilitator but not a great facilitator to make him work?
Maybe. I mean, the thing with LaMarcus that makes this so challenging in general is that the stats really never were, like, incredibly high on him in terms of the advanced metrics in the past. And so, like, when he had a 30% usage rate with the Blazers, you know, a couple seasons, he was considered a pretty good but not, like, a great, you know, franchise-carrying type of talent. And so, you know, you're going to need something like that, and Leonard is that, in order to beat a team like the Warriors.
Yeah, I mean, so last season when he had probably his best, you know, efficiency-wise playoffs, a lot of his best minutes came with that bench unit when he was being fed by Manu Ginobili, when he was, you know, paired up with different things. Like, he actually didn't play that well, and at least offensively, when he was paired with the starting unit last year.
So let's talk a little bit about the Warriors, since it's not entirely about the Spurs and Kawhi. Our colleague Chris Herring wrote a post for 538 about how the Warriors don't start trying until they're down 15 is the headline. And it's basically noting that when most teams are down by 15, they lose 90% of the time, whereas the Warriors basically are 50-50. And so, you know, what I'm trying to understand is we already know the Warriors are really good. And so is it surprising to find out that when they're down, they're still really good and have a good chance of coming back? Because to me, obviously a 25-point run like they went on the other night, that seems superhuman even for
and
a
especially
really
against
good team.
The Spurs. I don't know what the number was, like 316-0 and having a 25-point
Greg Popovich is that good when having the 25-point lead. So I'm just trying to understand how to put into context a comeback like that when we know the team's really good, because good teams are supposed to be able to make comebacks.
Well, I mean, you know, I think the Warriors as a team are built in a way that would probably make you think that they were more capable of comebacks specifically than even a team, you know, that might have been built a different way but had, like, you know, just as good of a record, because they can shoot so well and they can kind of, you know, shoot their way back into games. And one of the big things just about these playoffs in general, but you saw it in the game the other day, is that Curry seems to be, you know, back into his sort of form of a couple of years ago. We had talked in the past about how, you know, he seemed to have dropped off a little bit this year, and about how difficult it is for players to play better in the playoffs than they did during the regular season. And so far, Curry is playing much better in the playoffs, and especially, you know, in game one against San Antonio, than he did through most of the regular season.
Yeah, so I mean, part of this is there are other teams that have made, you know, a decent amount of 15-point comebacks to win. The Raptors did it, the Kings did it this year, but like those tend to be teams that, you know, are down 15 more often. It just seems like the Warriors, whenever they go down 15, they hit this gear, kind of like those old Celtics teams, like the KG Celtics, the LeBron Heat, and they can go on these runs. And part of that is having guys who can, you know, go on a run all on their own. So there's this stat that is guys who go on scoring runs of five or more across all points. So, like, usually that's, you know, hitting a three and, you know, coming down the other way, hitting a two in some order. And Steph Curry is consistently in, like, the top one or two. Harden was actually a little bit ahead of him this year, but usually, like, Curry's way out in front of everyone. And then, like, Klay Thompson is, you know, coming up right behind him. So, I mean, just having guys who, you know, just all on their own can generate this offense really, really quickly, that's a big part of it.
Okay, on the other side of the playoff bracket are the Eastern Conference Finals, which are now set after a Game 7 victory by the Celtics over the Wizards. It was a weird game, a weird series, sloppy and lots of hot and cold shooting. And so quickly, we don't have a ton of time remaining, but I'm just wondering, have we seen anything yet from the Celtics that suggests that the Cavs might be in trouble? And maybe that's a euphemism of saying, when you go seven games in the preceding series
against the Washington Wizards,
and when your opponent has just swept the two series prior, to me, that's like basically all I need to know about how this is going to go down. But am I being naive in thinking that there's a lot of information packed in there?
Well, didn't we do a thing, Kyle, you and I may have done something like this last year, where we tried to figure out whether rest or rust was a factor, and it ended up like it didn't actually matter how many days off.
Oh, I didn't mean that. I meant more like
that they had to go seven games.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. If you lose three times to the Wizards and your opponent has not lost a single time, yeah, then that suggests they're better.
Yeah, maybe the rest-rust thing doesn't matter at that point.
I mean, the go-to is always, you know, the 08 Celtics. They went 7, you know, 7-7-7 and then won the thing. But yeah, I mean, for me, it's less about the Celtics because they had some weird matchup things. And more so just, I want to see someone beat these Cavs. Like, the Cavs look really, really good. And even
but
their defensive.
They looked so bad during the year.
They did, but, like, every metric that we have, like, not just, you know, the broad ones, like, their offense has been better than the Warriors, true shooting and points per possession, but, like, they're getting more corner threes. Like, all their role players are playing their roles, like, more so. Like, Kevin Love is now purely a role player for them, almost. Like, almost half of his three-pointers are in the corner. He's taking more of his shots as three-pointers. Like, he's playing LeBron ball.
So, then why is the 538 model?
Why is it at 5%?
So, the Eastern Conference Finals is basically an even split between the Cavs and the Celtics. 48% Cavs, 52% Celtics. The Celtics are favored. And the chance to win the title, the Cavs, for some reason, have a bigger chance. I'm not sure why. 5% to win the title for the Cavs, even though they are one series away from only having one more opponent. So what about the numbers behind the Cavs continue to just not look that
good.
Did they
just rack up too many bad numbers during the regular season?
I think that's exactly. I mean, it's kind of garbage in, garbage out, right? Like if a model is based solely on data from the regular season and you have a team that sort of, whether or not it was willful, whether or not it was sort of a mix of just resting plus like not necessarily playing their best ball late in the season, if you don't kind of come out of the regular season with dominating numbers and there's another team out there that does in the case of the Warriors, then what should we really be that surprised that some kind of, you know, projection model is going to not view you that highly? But now the question is, you know, what are the things that we can do to account for what the rest of the world knows and what the gambling markets know, which is that the Cavs were not properly represented by the regular season numbers. And that's something where you kind of have to, you know, rely on whatever the underlying talent of the team is and try to figure out in the past what has been the best predictor, what mix of the two has been the best predictor. And that's, you know, something that probably for every case where you want to make that adjustment up for a team like the Cavs, you would might end up overcorrecting and being like, oh yeah, they'll flip the switch later, and they never do. We just kind of remember the cases like the 2001 Lakers and like this Cavs team where the switch did get successfully flipped. It's an interesting question.
Well, what, Neil, the model says 5% chance for the Cavaliers to win the title. Mm. Human Neil, what percentage do the Cavaliers have to win the title?
You know, I would say probably, you know, it would be in the 20%, you know, ish range, I would think, probably, or, you know, high teens or something like that. Like, the Warriors are ridiculously good. And the Cavs, as great as they've looked in the playoffs, they haven't been beaten yet. They still, I don't think, have fixed the defensive issues that really kind of plagued them throughout the regular season and down the stretch. They've just played out of their minds on offense, and they haven't really been challenged that much and haven't really had to kind of clamp down that much on defense. So I think in some ways we are kind of overstating how much of a, you know, open and shut case it is that this team has fixed all of its problems. But I do think that the model is pretty significantly underrating the Cavs.
Okay, one last thing before we go. We would be remiss if we did not mention Kelly Olynyk's name, the folk hero that Boston deserves and needs.
Or needs, yeah.
So, Kyle, how surprised were you by his, what was it, 24 points outburst in Game 7? And is there any chance that this guy is actually a 24-point kind of player?
Well, no, there's not. But not that surprised that someone did it for the Celtics, because they have like a pretty interesting roster makeup where they have 11 guys in the playoffs shooting more than a quarter of their shots from 3-point. Usually you'll have about 5 on a team. And like a few of those are like James Young, Jonas Jerebko, who, you know, aren't getting a ton of minutes. But among those guys, 8 of them are shooting at least 35%. That's league average. And if you believe in the hot hand, and, you know, at this point in the cycle on debating the hot hand, we believe it's true.
We're not in the
real
backlash phase anymore.
We think it's true, but also that, you know, guys, you know, are feeling themselves more and more, and, you know, hot hand versus heat check, and those tend to cancel each other out. But if you have 8 guys who can shoot league average, you know, it stands to reason that one of them is going to turn up with a game like Olynyk every now and then, and that might carry you through a series.
All right, Kyle Wagner, thanks for coming on and talking about the NBA.
Thanks.
If you want to read more of Kyle's work, you can find it on 538.com. We'll put some links on Hot Takedown's show page. Before we keep going with this week's show, let's get a word from one of our sponsors. Hot Takedown this week is sponsored by ZipRecruiter. You cannot find all the best candidates that you need for your job at your business just by posting your job description on one site. You need to post it on all the top job sites, and now you can with ZipRecruiter. At ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with one click. Then ZipRecruiter's powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your position. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. No juggling emails or calls to your office any longer. All you have to do with ZipRecruiter is screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place. And that place, of course, is ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. So find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes nationwide, and you can do it for free just by going to ZipRecruiter.com/takedown. That's ZipRecruiter.com. ZipRecruiter.com/takedown. Again, you can try it for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/takedown. Okay, now let's move on to baseball, where earlier this week, Derek Jeter's number was retired for the Yankees, number two, the captain. Derek Jeter, of course, infamous for leading the Yankees to all sorts of championships during that great run in the 90s that they had, was a rookie during the 96 World Series championship that they won, so sort of was a homegrown prospect that also embodied this championship ethos of the Yankees. You know, we went looking for a hot take that said Jeter wasn't that good, but what we found was something on the other side of that coin. So here's Adam Schein saying, you know, that maybe we don't appreciate who Derek Jeter really was.
Derek Jeter as a baseball player, underrated. Yeah, that's right. I said it. Underrated. Derek Jeter is the single best shortstop in the history of Major League Baseball. Number one. Not number two, not number five. I actually think, and postseason's part of it, Derek Jeter, arguably the greatest postseason performer in the history of baseball, which takes his legacy, as it should, to a whole nother level. That's how it works. That's what he's done. He actually, as a regular season player, I think was vastly underrated. I mean, over 3,000 hits, the games played, stolen bases, batting average, runs, RBI. He was so tough and clutch over the course of 162 games.
I noticed that while that take was playing, Neil was cringing at the stats that were listed.
It was an interesting...
In favor of Derek Jeter, and having attended many a stat school, I couldn't help but wonder whether those stats, although certainly reflective of the strength of Derek Jeter's career, perhaps not as representative as other stats could be for Derek Jeter.
Yeah, well, I was mainly cringing when he said that he was, like, bar none, the greatest shortstop of all time, and just weeping for Honus Wagner and the great Archie Vaughn. Can we get someone creating a hot take about Archie Vaughn?
What about Cal Ripken, guys?
Cal Ripken's had enough, lionizing over the years. Oh, but okay. Even Cal Ripken is.
But Cal Ripken was a better shortstop than
far greater.
Yeah,
than Derek
I didn't know that we had to name shortstops that weren't appropriately praised.
Yeah,
because I think Honus Wagner maybe Neil just because of his baseball card.
Neil only accepts comparables that are at least from 1960s or before.
Yeah, he's got to be impressive in his comparables.
Yeah, you got to go back pretty far.
Okay, so let's talk about Jeter and sort of where he stands in his legacy.
And the sad thing is, I went into this like. Actually trying to be on the side of Jeter is kind of underrated. We have taken a crap on his legacy as stat heads a little too much.
Has that really happened?
That one particular like hot take really like, you know,
but answer Kate's question. I mean, is our legacy of Jeter warped by, well, so there's two different directions, right? The sort of championship heads would say, listen, this guy is a winner. You know, that's who Derek Jeter is. He led the most successful franchise of all time to even more success. And as a result, you know, there's that, and he has the famous plays to prove it, the big hits, the backhanded.
He dove into the stands face first.
He did that little shovel pass,
whatever.
That
is the most overrated play in the history of Major League Baseball.
And so there's that side of it, which is that he could never be lauded enough because he embodied what it is to be a baseball player.
Also a true Yankee.
Also because he was a media savvy individual. Then. There's the stat head argument, if I understand it correctly, Neil, which is that clutch is not a thing. That there's no such thing as clutch, and so Jeter's big hits should not be taken as though they're anything more than the dice roll that came up in the right number during the right moment. And that his defense sucked, and so we don't appreciate just how many balls went through the infield because Jeter was out there.
Yeah, I think that about sums it up. I mean, it's interesting that Jeter came along when he did. I think that is one of the things that makes him an interesting player because of all of the things that you mentioned, like the postseason resume and the perceived kind of clutch hitting ability and all of these things, the batting average, those were things that would have played so well in a previous generation that we wouldn't even have like a conversation. Like he would be in the conversation for like, you know, is he the greatest player of all time or you know, right up there with the greatest players of all time.
Can I interrupt you real quick?
Go ahead.
A .310 average for his career, and an OPS that was 817 or so. So, you know, this is a clearly good baseball player. There's no questioning that.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't think anyone, even from like the most hardcore stat head perspective, is saying like Jeter is a bad baseball player, or even like Jeter, he's nothing special. He's an average player or something like that. I think it's universally acknowledged that he's a great player and one of the best shortstops of all time. But I think because he came along when he did, he had the misfortune of the sabermetric movement sort of coming of age and using him as the particular kind of example or case study or whatever you want to call it, cautionary tale, where it's like, oh, this guy that you, with your eye test and your primitive fielding percentage, thought was the best defensive shortstop imaginable with the gold gloves. Turns out our numbers say he's not just not the best, he's actually the worst by like an absurd margin. So there goes that argument. Oh, you think clutch is a real thing? Well, we have a bunch of studies saying clutch isn't a real thing and is not a repeatable skill. And Jeter actually isn't even that clutch anyway if we, you know, when we do try to measure what it means to be clutch. So there goes that argument. And, you know, you can kind of like go down the list of things that like Jeter in 50 years earlier would have been, you know, the best cases for him as being like, you know, one of the best of all time, and just knock them out one by one until you end up with what you basically have, which is one of the best shortstops of all time, not anywhere near the best, and, you know, one of the best Yankees of all time, full stop.
All right, Neil, so it sounds like Jeter is the inverse of Tim Raines.
Like in terms of a stat head, yeah, like instead of being an advocate for a certain player.
Right, all of a sudden stats illuminate that we think a guy is a better player than we saw him using the eye test. Like, he kind of degrades a little bit when you use advanced metrics.
And like,
what is it about his fielding? I mean, because like, wouldn't that be noticeable on the eye test? Like, if I watch Jeter, I'm like, shouldn't I have noticed, like, oh, he doesn't have a ton of range?
Well, I think what's really interesting about defense in baseball is there's like a certain zone at which the worse you are at it, the more impressive it looks, because plays that should be routine or are routine to like really, truly great players. And you see this, you know, like people always said Jim Edmonds in the outfield would dive for balls that Andrew Jones would catch standing up. So we would pay attention to Jim Edmonds' great diving catch and not even notice in the course of watching the game that Andrew Jones would have made that play without any kind of problem whatsoever. The same thing went for Jeter, except even more so, because, you know, the phrase, how many times did John Sterling say pass to diving Jeter when calling games? And, you know, we wouldn't even notice when there was a great comparison made by Bill James, the father of sabermetrics, between Jeter and Adam Everett, who was a shortstop for the Houston Astros for a long time. And Everett made something on the order of, like, you know, dozens upon dozens of plays and turned ground balls into outs at shortstop each season that Jeter just never even got to. And so that's something that we, just in the course of watching a game, probably wouldn't notice, because the ball doesn't get hit to Jeter that often each game. And so you'd have to watch like every Yankee game, and you'd have to kind of remind yourself every time you saw him make like a great, you know, diving play or something, that actually, you know, would Adam Everett have gotten to that standing up? It can be a little bit challenging without the numbers.
And just for listeners maybe rudimentary like myself, is that because of the advent of technology, like where we're actually measuring how many yards or feet Jeter is covering in that shortstop hole?
Well, I mean, nowadays we do have the ability to do that. For like Jeter's career, you had to rely on like stringers who would record for each you know, ball that was put in play where the ball was hit on these like slivers of the field, and sort of determine, okay, well, when a ball is hit here, here's how often, based on the sample that we have of historical balls hit to the shortstop, you know, to 2 feet to the right of the shortstop, how often do those balls ultimately, you know, turn into outs? And then you can also say, how often do balls get turned into outs when they are hit to Derek Jeter specifically? And you can kind of do this plus minus thing where it's like you can actually determine relative to the average shortstop on the set of balls that were hit to Jeter how many the average shortstop would have turned into outs versus how many he turned into outs.
Okay, so he's a more complicated player than we make him out to be. Does that mean that he didn't deserve to be, have his number retired? I mean, it seems
did
to
it have
like,
to be on Mother's Day?
That was intentional. He did it on purpose.
But it seems to me like what we're really talking about is gradations of greatness.
Yeah.
And I think that's often, for me, what's lost in the conversation around, like, an easy-to-poke-holes-in player like Jeter, which is that you're not, like, debasing him down to being Ray Ordonez or something. I mean, this guy is still...
No, Ray Ordonez was good at defense.
But I mean, Jeter is still an all-time Yankee, someone who is going to go down in their franchise's history as, like, the player you tell your kids stories about.
Like, I saw him play.
Yeah, but you know what? It was deserving to tell those stories. It's not like he's not deserving of those kind of accolades.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that is sort of the thing that gets lost when you're trying to combat, you know, hyperbole with maybe, like, counter-hyperbole, or at least the instinct to say, like, oh, Jeter wasn't that great. Because he was great. I mean, if you kind of add up the war of all Yankee players while they were wearing pinstripes, Jeter is the fourth best Yankee of all time, only trailing Babe Ruth, Mickey Mantle, and Lou Gehrig. He's ahead of Joe DiMaggio. He's ahead of, you know, Yogi Berra, Bernie Williams, Ron Guidry, all of these people.
But does he have a jazz guitar career?
We don't know. Jeter's, you know, currently managing his editorial empire with the Players Tribune.
And he's the owner of the Marlins soon.
Right, yeah. But the point is that, I mean, the Yankees are unquestionably the most successful franchise in baseball history by leaps and bounds. And we're talking about a player who is one of the handful of greatest players in that franchise's history. That makes him a historically important, you know, valuable player, even if, you know, when you start to parse into some of the other stuff that we just talked about, you know, maybe some of the shine comes off. It shouldn't come off mostly.
And Chad, you alluded to the media savvy part of Derek Jeter, which, having covered teams, does matter when it comes to how a newspaper in that particular city is going to cover your exploits or your moments when you do come up with a big hit in the late innings and then perpetuate whatever storyline that has started about how you perform at the end of games or any part of your career. And I mean, Derek Jeter mastered that. And so I'm wondering if when it comes to the part of, like, this concept of him as always being clutch, I would attribute some of that to the coverage of him in New York and the almost like the desperate want to plaster him everywhere and canonize him.
And I think, you know, you have to find an easy sort of, like, player to credit when a team wins a lot. And so I think, especially in a sport like baseball, the best player on a team probably gets too much credit and maybe too much blame when they lose. But certainly when you win as much as the Yankees did during the 90s, it's a lot easier to give Jeter the lion's share of the credit than also say that, like, Jeter, who also played with Andy Pettit and Bernie Williams and Jorge Posada and all of these other great players. I mean, those teams, Mariano Rivera, you know, not even to mention him, those teams were stacked with ridiculous rosters, and so Jeter contributed to that and was also the beneficiary of that, and he, because of what you said, the media environment in New York at the time, became the face of this also great group of teammates.
Okay, let's leave it there. Derek, that's your hot takedown appreciation.
Yeah,
have we even
talked about him?
I think it was.
Okay.
It said, you are great, but you're not the greatest. I would be fine with that opening.
But also great.
If you guys want to just, like, come to my funeral.
You
say,
were the fourth best Yankee.
Yeah, Chad was the fourth best podcast host at 538. Now, there are only four podcasts.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's kind of weak.
All right, let's go from baseball to all the sports. We're going to talk about home court advantage because of a stat that caught Neil's eye, last week or so, Neil, when you were interested in writing about the Stanley Cup playoffs. At the time, I'm not sure what the home record was of those teams, but right now it stands at 36-36 during the Stanley Cup playoffs. And, you know, we like to think that home court advantage means something, especially in the playoffs where the environment perhaps could be louder and more invested, and we'll talk about whether crowd noise even factors in this. But then, Neil, you were like, wait, 36-36, is that normal for hockey? And then how does that compare to other sports? So the stat man put on his cape.
Yay!
He sat down at his computer.
So exciting.
He booted up Excel.
Is there a YouTube video of this?
Oh, yes.
Someday.
And Neil, after hours of work, what'd you find?
First of all, I just wanted to kind of figure out in general what's the boost that teams get at home during the regular season after taking into account, you know, how good the teams in each matchup are. And so I found that in the NBA, the home team wins about 60% of the time. In the NFL, 57%, in baseball, 54%, and in hockey, 55%. So, you know, hockey, the second lowest home ice advantage, I guess you'd call it.
And let me stop you there.
Mm-hmm.
Is that because of how random hockey is? Like, we talk a lot about that sort of thing.
And I wonder, too, how much of it has to do with that there's so clear possession. And I know there's clear possession in NHL, but it's not as much like with your football team. Like, my team has the ball, and if I'm in a stadium and I need the ball back, then I'm, like, screaming like crazy, you know, during the offensive line count. And in basketball, there's a clear definition of possession. We all have a clear understanding of it. And same with baseball, with possession being like, who's at bat? Does that, in your mind, have anything to do with it? Because in hockey, it's just so much more fluid that there's not as much time to, like, build up some kind of in-game crowd noise that actually affects something?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's a coincidence that it does seem to go in order of what we've talked about before, which is the order of sort of like from least random to most random of the sports. We've talked about basketball as being the sport that the best team seems to win the most often in easily compared to the other sports. And there's probably no coincidence that it's also the sport in which the home court advantage shows up the most because of what you said. You know, whatever advantages are being conferred upon the home team, whether it's the crowd being behind them, whether it's not, you know, them getting favorable calls from the officials. There's been some research showing that a lot of home advantage boils down to referees kind of giving you a beneficial treatment. All of those things that kind of make you the better team, quote unquote, that day are kind of amplified in a sport where being the better team matters more. Whereas in hockey, because of the just kind of chaos of rolling and sliding a piece of rubber along ice, it's going to be harder to capitalize on those advantages and kind of make them show up in a meaningful way. Now, what I thought was interesting was the additional boost that teams get in the playoffs because so in the NFL, the home team wins, and in the NBA, both the home team wins playoff games at 65% in both leagues, which is a big boost even above and beyond what you see during the regular season. And that's after controlling for the fact that home teams, you know, better teams during the regular season tend to get rewarded in the playoffs with more home games. They still see about a 4 to 5 percentage point boost in how much they
win
at home.
And then what about for the more random ones?
And for the more random ones, it's almost no change from the regular season to the playoffs. You see in MLB, it doesn't change at all. And in hockey, it actually drops a little bit after you control for who gets to play home games, which I thought was the most interesting thing and goes back to your original point, Chad, about the NHL playoffs. We expect to see home teams win more than they lose, especially in a playoff situation. But maybe we've been spoiled by some of the other sports, and maybe we shouldn't be that surprised that they're basically breaking even in hockey.
So before we get to why this might be, Kate, when you were a player, what did home court mean for you?
The most important thing to home court, other than the crowd noise, and this not as relevant to a professional team, but definitely within the NCAA, is that you had different basketballs everywhere you went.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And so we were sponsored by Nike, and we had these distinct Nike balls that were softer, and then you went elsewhere, and if they were sponsored by Rawlings or Spalding, it was like a different kind of basketball. And we didn't practice with those basketballs. And that's true across the NCAA. But when so many of those variables are controlled for at the professional level, that wouldn't obviously like disrupt those teams. And so to me, it would be totally just crowd noise and then travel. And that has to be it.
And so, but you felt sometimes as though you were tired because you took an all-night bus or a flight or whatever. And you're like, oh, man, I still got to play basketball tonight or the next day. And you think that would have affected your performance?
Yeah, I think it, marginally it would have. Everything was, although you had your routine on the road, it was different and less natural to your state as a human than your routine at home.
Okay, so Neil, what do the numbers tell us about what actually changes because someone's at home?
Yeah, I mean, so travel distance and probably the sleep factor and all of that, just fatigue, is definitely one of the things that we've seen when we built our various predictive models that has a real tangible effect on who wins. And the other thing, like I mentioned earlier, is really the refereeing slash umpiring, whatever you want to call it, bias. There's some studies in baseball that show that even in terms of balls and strikes that are called, umpires tend to vary the shape of the strike zone in favor of the home team. And kind of to make matters worse, this effect becomes bigger as the leverage index of the game gets higher. In other words, in more important moments in the game, umpires seem to be more sort of easily able to be influenced by the crowd. And people don't really know if this is like, you know, just unconscious bias that, like, as humans, where we get caught up in the moment ourselves, and it's very difficult to kind of, with thousands of screaming fans kind of trying to focus their energy on a certain call being made, to tune that out. There's still a lot that we don't know about what causes home field advantage, but that definitely seems to be one of the big driving forces behind it.
And that you would want to be liked, right, is essentially what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, it could be. They've done some studies where, because, and I don't know what this says about the state of stereotypes in soccer fandom, but there's been a lot of cases around the world in soccer where, because of rowdy fans and various, like, riot-like atmospheres and things, they've played games in front of an empty stadium. They haven't invited the fans inside because they created too much ruckus. And in those games, it provides like a nice test case, right, to see if this officiating bias persists even when there aren't the people kind of screaming at the ref. And they found that it pretty much does disappear, like in these special circumstances. And again, it's like a very small sample of games, that when the crowd isn't there, that the factors that drive home advantage tend to be reduced. And again, that's something that needs more study, and certainly you can't count out the fatigue factors and things, but that does tend to suggest that the crowd is a big factor in it.
All right, so lessons for those listening at home. When your team has a home game, show up, be loud, bully the refs or the umps or the yeah. officials. Anything else that we've make sure that you don't disturb your home team players at home in bed at night. Don't go outside their apartment and start screaming things. But do go outside the visiting team's hotel and scream within the legal limits.
I think that's what we learned.
Yeah, in some ways, I mean, it should be kind of encouraging. People always say, like, oh, as a fan, I don't really have any control over what happens on the field. I'm
Look at this.
Just kind of like rooting.
You've got this small percentage
something.
Control.
But you do have some kind of control.
In some of the sports.
You can manipulate certain referees and umpires into getting a small increased number of calls.
And we've even seen.
So as long as you yell loud enough, you will see. Long enough, you will
see
results.
I mean, we've even seen some interesting results in a story that we published last year about. This isn't even fans. This is coaches who kind of work the referees in football, that when the referee is closer to your sideline during football games and the coach is theoretically yelling at them, that's when your team tends to get the most favorable call. So it really does psychologically, you know, the effect of just, you know, psychologically intimidating the referee works.
Robot umpires. They're coming.
They're infallible.
So they
can't be influenced.
They can't be bought. All right, let's leave it there and move on. Okay, now it's time for our significant digit, when a telling number from the world of sports is brought to us by me today. Folks.
It's a departure.
Our significant digit. You know, I've been bringing more and more. You know, I've been trying to bring more to the plate. Speaking of plates.
Oh, good transition. You're a professional.
Thank you so much. Our significant digit today is the number one seed. The number one seeded softball team in the country, NCAA softball, women's softball, is not seeded at all in the tournament, in the softball NCAA tournament.
Wait, so the number one overall ranked team.
Based on coaches' poll.
Okay.
Has no seeding whatsoever in the 64 field.
How?
Because there are only 16 seeds that happen inside of the tournament. So it's seeded 1 through 16. and then the rest are just open, and those 16 seeds get to host sort of mini tournament games. And somehow the number one team in the nation, according to a new coaches poll, just is not one of the top 16, according to the selection committee.
What team is this, by the way?
The Minnesota Gophers.
The Golden Gophers.
That's, I would not think that they had a strong softball program.
Well, they're 54-3 this season.
Whoa, that's pretty crazy.
In the poll that came out before the selections were done, they were ranked second in the coaches poll. They're now ranked first after it came out, and 11th in RPI. So there's just no universe in which you can say they don't deserve one of the top 16 seasons.
Has there been like an explanation forthcoming?
Well,
how they have the guy
NCAA
come on?
Selection
yeah,
committee.
Yeah, the selection committee chairman comes on.
Chad, you got this?
Let me put on my best sportocrat voice. When selecting the top 16 seeds, the committee emphasizes a team's performance against top 25 teams, along with other variables, including strength of schedule. When the committee compared Minnesota against other teams being considered for the top 16 seeds, Minnesota did not have as many regular season top 10 and top 25 wins as compared to other teams. The teams that were selected as the 16 seeds had at least one or more top 10 wins, and between 4 to 18 more top 25 wins. Minnesota did not have any top 10 wins, and only 2 top 25 wins. So basically, they're victims of their schedule. Their strength of schedule is 114th in the country.
So also of their conference schedule, I would assume
maybe
that the
Pac-12
and the SEC, I don't assume. I know they're really good at softball.
All 13 SEC teams made the field of 64.
Right.
Yeah, so, but it just
but
strikes
still.
Me. Talk about the eye test. If you have the coaches ranking a team number one, I'm not saying they deserve to be the number one seed in the tournament. I don't know. I've not watched
maybe
enough
they do.
NCAA
maybe they
softball
don't.
This year. But something has clearly gone wrong when you have coaches at total odds
especially
with the selection
committee. When what's on the table is a home game.
Right.
I do kind of like the idea. First of all, this would never happen in something like, you know, men's NCAA basketball or something.
Or women's,
like,
really.
Yeah,
considering
like you
how
would,
much attention is.
Yeah, the outpouring of anger or whatever, the backlash would be so crazy. But I think that when in those situations, you can become so afraid of the backlash that there starts to be some like groupthink and hurting and things like that. Whereas here, it sounds like such little attention is being paid that you actually are having like independent assessments or evaluations being made. Now, one has 100% of the weight because it determines who gets to be seated where in the tournament. But if you took like an average, I mean, that's the whole idea of the wisdom of crowds, right? Is that you have people making independent assessments without knowing what the other people are thinking or what criteria they're using. And then when you average them together, you end up with a better assessment than if you were kind of peeked at someone else's paper and then kind of like made the assessment that way.
Are you making the argument for the BCS right now?
I don't know if I'm making the argument for the BCS.
That was computers plus
that
coaches.
It is kind of, but I think that they probably use, I mean, it's sort of people that were associated with the coaches or athletic departments that had a lot of input in what got valued by the computer ratings. But the point is that seeing independent assessment of things, if they get averaged together, is good. In this case, okay. It sounds like they're not being averaged.
Well, Minnesota's got to go prove it on the field.
That's right. You know, if they're true champions, they're going to fight their way
prove
through.
Prove it on the field, Minnesota.
So the way that works, just to be clear, the 16 top seeds, they host a double elimination pool of games, and then the victors of those
goes
pools
the spoils.
They go to the super regional or something like that. And so, but I'm gonna root for the Gophers. I feel really attached to this team just by nature of how jobs they got. All right, that will do it for this week's show. Thanks for talking about sports, Kate Fagan.
And my other name?
You want to fidget with the spinner?
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Chad.
Neil, thanks for talking about sports.
Thanks, Chad.
Our producer is Katie Ferguson. Our podcast selection committee is Jody Avergan. We got production assistance from Tony Chow and Jorge Estrada. You can email us at... Oh, no, not Jorge.
I was going to say,
it's
he
just written down here. Oh, no, Jorge, we still miss you. Just production
old
assistance
habits.
From Tony Chow. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. Find us on your favorite podcasting app. We're on iTunes, of course, as well. Subscribe at itunes.com/538. While you're there, wherever it is that you are, be sure to review and or rate the show. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I am Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.